This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk.
Well, I think what alcohol does is it blinkers you to who you are, but also who you can be. It dulls you and numbs you and blinds you to your potential, to your complete potential. And sobriety gives you ambition, it gives you foresight, it gives you insight, it gives you the whole picture, doesn't it? You know, it just, the things that you can do, like, and the money I've saved. I never had savings. I used to, you know, I didn't spend everything, but I never really had any personal wealth. But now I've got ISAs, I've got leases, we've been overpaying our mortgage by 100% every month since we got sober, because Paul's sober too, my husband. 100% every month we've been paying off our mortgage because we were squandering that much money, not solely on alcohol. But when you drink, you become much more inhibited, don't you? You become much more fickle and frivolous. And I think that percolates into everyday life when you drink. Like, you'll say yes to things that you shouldn't say yes to more easily. And so alcohol, the lack of alcohol in our life has given us so much. It's given us a business. It's given us a bit of money in the bank. It's given us time together. We value our time so much.
Just some of the benefits there of alcohol-free life from this week's guest, John Waite. And if you're thinking, I know that name, I recognise his voice. He's been on the podcast before. I think it was about 12 months ago. So go back and take a listen to that earlier episode if you want to find out about John's backstory. It's a brilliant catch-up this week. We've got loads to talk about with John. He's a sober superstar. Let's get into the episode.
Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hello, I'm Aaron and I live in Bonnie, Scotland. My life used to revolve around alcohol. I went to the local pub every night. All of my friends drank and I couldn't imagine a life without booze. Slowly but surely, time took its toll and I got tired of this life. Sober curious, I took a leap and joined OTI. How my life has changed. I'm now a year and a half sober and loving every minute of it. For me, OTI is a place where we can celebrate the joys of alcohol-free life without any judgment. The most amazing connections and friendships have been made through this community. Come join us and have a good laugh at the same time.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to this week's episode of Over the Influence. We're dead chuffed, dead excited to get into today's chat. Really looking forward to it. You've already heard this person on the pod before, so just hold that thought for 1 second. Quick reintroductions as to who we are, maybe if you are joining us for the first time. My name's Sharon Hartley. Everybody calls me Shaz. 50. I'm 50 now, flipping heck. And I stopped drinking coming up for nearly 6 years ago, which is bonkers. It's still brilliant. I still love it. Only regret is that I did not do it sooner. However, it is never too late to make that change. I drank too much, too often, and too quickly, like it was going out of fashion. I drank like there was a panic on when it came to rosé wine. Anyway, I don't do that anymore, and it's ace. So we want to let you know that actually a life without booze is possible. And not only that, you can flipping well enjoy it. We harp on about sobriety week in, week out, not on my own. Ben Anderson, how the hell are you?
Hi, very well, thanks, Shaz. I'm Ben, I'm 36, I live in Liverpool, and I'm now over 4 years alcohol-free, and it's great. I'm going to do it again, just because John's here and he might not have heard it yet. Because Sharon, for me, fulfilling my potential became more important than refilling my glass. Look, I know I've said it lots on episodes recently,
like that.
But John might not have heard it. John might not have heard it. I wanted John to hear it. I am delighted that we've got our guest on today. Shaz, you can do the big intro, because all I've got written down on my pad is pleather trousers. Yours might be more professional.
No, mine says General Gobshite.
General Gobshite, okay.
I need to explain why.
Yeah.
We are chuffed a bit to have John Waite joining us on the podcast this week. And before we started recording, I said to John, how would you like us to introduce you, John? Because you are a man of many talents. And John, what did you say?
I said I'm a general gobshite.
There you go. And I wrote that on my pad. you're in good company, let me tell you, John. It's really, really good to have you back. Before we get into everything and have a good old catch up, how are you doing?
Do you know, I am a different person these days. I'm amazing. I feel so... I think what Ben said just a second ago, that lovely little mantra that you might find quilted onto a sofa or something like that in a cheap cheap houseware shop. I feel like I'm fulfilling my potential now. I really, really do. And the life changes that I've made, you know, since last speaking to you, have impacted every single part of my life, you know, my relationships. And we'll get into it all, of course we will, but every single facet of John Waite is now a better facet, is a better version because of making the choice that I've made to not drink alcohol.
Love that. It's brilliant. And what we won't do during the course of this episode is go back and talk about your drinking days and, you know, when you made the change, because if you want to hear that and you've not heard John's story before, just rewind. Was it about 12 months ago, John? Maybe something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was about this time last year, actually.
Yeah, something like that. So go back and listen to that episode with John, because it's an absolute belter. I love that, John, what you said. We quite often say on the podcast that drinking and alcohol, if it becomes problematic, impacts every area of your life, like negatively, mm-hmm. you know, be it big, small or whatever. Remove it and every single aspect of life improves positively. Tell us what it's been like since we last chatted.
It's just, I mean, I've achieved so much. You know, I've got married for a start, which...
Congratulations!
You know, well, it was really... On the last podcast, I speak about kind of how it impacted my relationship a little bit. But, you know, we just realised that I am on the straight and narrow, and I can get married and stay married. And I won't get drunk and go and, you know, wake up in a stranger's bed, which happened a lot. You know, it did. So... Yeah, we've got married, set up a business as well, kind of stepped away from television because I realise now how negatively that really was impacting me as well. I've just made some really strong, bold choices. Many choices people would say, why the hell have you done that? Like, why would you kind of step away from a TV career? I've not stepped away completely, but I'm much more fussy now with what I would say yes to. And that's because I now have a lot more self-respect. You know, I'm like one of these bolshy grandmothers who I always used to love hanging around with when I was little. Like, I always wanted to be a bolshy. I wanted to be Meryl Streep, you know, I wanted to be an Oscar-winning actress. And now I understand why, because what those women had were firm boundaries. That's what I craved. They were very strict with me. But, you know, that's genuinely how I feel now, like someone who knows who he is. I know who I am, and I'm happy with it, warts and all.
John, was it in New York? Did you get married in New York? Did you honeymoon in New York? Because that's where I saw the pleather trousers on your Instagram.
Yeah, the pleather trousers were not a part of the wedding, but we did get married in New York. So
yeah, looked amazing.
I was doing pantomime over last winter. And let me tell you something, if anything makes you want to pick up the bottle, it's pantomime. But I didn't. I didn't touch a drop.
We didn't. Sorry, John.
I was waiting
for Shaz to do it. I thought she's going to...
No,
sorry. What
do you
say?
Should have closed my laptop.
Yeah, please do. I wanted to close mine. Right.
See awful.
So we decided during that we'd go and see this amazing show called Hades Town in New York. And if you haven't seen it, it's in London as well now. It's incredible. And when we booked the New York trip, we were like, should we get married? Because we always threatened to get married, and we always started planning to get married. And then whenever we planned to get married, something like the patio or the driveway would come along. We'd have to do that up and spend the money on that instead. And also, when we started planning our wedding about 5 years ago in the UK, my mother, another bolshy woman who I admire and adore, said that we had to invite all of her friends. So we cancelled those plans and thought that we would elope. Like, we had this amazing celebrant called Yelenis Cruz, this Dominican chick who married us under the ladies pavilion on the lake in Central Park. And it was just the two of us and a photographer and Yelenis. And it was absolutely perfect. Like, I wore a kilt in February in New York. You know, I was freezing. I had some knickers on, though. I didn't go full Scotsman. I did put some knickers on. And, you know, it was just perfect. Like, before, and the reason I'm telling you this is the contrast between... The wedding that we were planning before was this great big spectacle. You know, it was in Gorton Monastery in Manchester. It was going to be this amazing event. And the wedding that we had was sacred. It was private. It was ours. And that really is, it demonstrates what sobriety does for you. It makes you respect this. It makes you have not a barrier, but a really firm wall that you can lean upon because you know who you are. And I think the wedding is the perfect example of that, how it could have been, but how it was.
It sounds like, John, because, you know, we come into these and we say at the beginning, like, this isn't an interview, it's a conversation. And it is, you know, we never quite know where these podcasts are going to go. It's one of the things I love about Over the Influence. But what you said there about the wedding, but also about work, is it sounds like, you know, you very clearly know the difference between what maybe people think that you should do because society says this is what success is and this is what you should do and this is glamorous and this is that and this is whatever, and actually what you want to do. And they can be really, really, really different things, can't they?
Completely. You know, people would think that because I was on Strictly and because I was on television, that had a really exciting, glamorous life. And you know what? For the most part, some of that work really was exciting. You can't deny the merit of Strictly and how brilliant that was. But what it did to me as a person was make me, well, it didn't make me because it's already within me. It kind of fed into that neuroses that I have, that neurotic self-loathing, body dysmorphia, body image hatred. It fed into all of that. It also put me in situations where I could very easily have taken a drink and in the past did. So I knew that television, and also there's no pension in television. There's no respect of workers in television for the most part. I'm not going to generalize, but for the most part, there's no respect of the freelancers. You know, Packed Lunch, Steph's Packed Lunch, for example, which was an amazing show. Channel 4 decided to drop it and 84 people lost their jobs. You know, that's the nature of the beast. And I thought to myself, I don't respect this enough. I don't respect the way that people are treated in the industry. And it's not pinpointing a person because it's the way the industry has evolved. It is what it is. It's just thanks, but no thanks. I'm not really down for that right now. I'd much rather try and do something that feeds into job security for people and pensions. And that's what I'm doing now as I start to, well, I've employed people and I'm looking for more people to work at my business. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of do something that was the complete contrast to that. And like I say, I would never say no to certain jobs on TV, and I still, you know, get offers and stuff like that for certain things. But I say no to those because it doesn't align with who I currently am. And that, as I think I said on the past podcast, who we are evolves and changes on an hourly, if not daily basis. You know, so we don't have to kind of write firmly in stone who we are, but who I am right now just doesn't really want to go down that pathway.
It's mad, isn't it, how it all changes? And I love the conversations around boundaries and as well people pleasing, because so much, I think, of what we experience as drinkers is a lack of boundaries and constant people pleasing. And yet, once the alcohol is removed, you're able to, I think in many ways, actually, John, unknowingly start to deal with those things. When did you find that there was more of a, I suppose, a self-realization, you know, that this was more about you. You're at the centre of this rather than other people.
I think that really came after Strictly, which we touched upon last time, I think, briefly, and kind of the destructive behaviour that I was engaging in after Strictly because I was on such a downer. And I looked back at all the repeated patterns of behaviour in my life and I realised that I was the common denominator. It was me. It was my choice to put the alcohol in my mouth. And often, as an I'd make an excuse and say, "Oh, poor John, he needs a drink. Go and have a drink, love, with your pals, and act like a dick." And really, it took me waking up to think, "Yeah, I was the dick. I was the common denominator in all of that." So, you know, that's it. Really, it wasn't a pinpointable moment. It was just a gentle and soft realization. But what's interesting is, I don't know if we mentioned it last time because I'm not sure I'd been diagnosed, but I got diagnosed very shortly after our conversation with ADHD.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about this next. No, you hadn't, and it's since happened. Please, God, tell us all about this. So, because it comes up a lot in our community as well with many of our members.
It's fascinating. So I wrote my memoir, which I talked about briefly last time. And a friend of mine who I was at Oxford Uni with, she read it and she said, "John, it's a great read, but this is like a textbook ADHD, a manuscript for ADHD. So I went and saw a specialist. Actually, it was a doctor who I was working on Steph's packed lunch with, Dr. Hussein. His wife, Shanaz, who is this gorgeous, gorgeous creature, she gave me an interview and said, yeah, I think you probably have got it. So let's go through the formal diagnostic process. And I went through all of that, which is a very, you know, it's quite an onerous thing. You've got loads of forms to fill out. You've got loads of interviews to have. They have to interview your parents, your partner, with a proper psychologist and a psychiatrist as well. And after that, they said, yeah, you've got quite severe ADHD. And beforehand, I thought, oh, it's one of them things, isn't it? You know, it's like a Mickey Mouse subject at university. I thought, oh, everyone's got ADHD. It's trendy. I looked at it quite ignorantly, like many people did at the time and still indeed do. And then when I started to read about it and go through the therapy and start taking the medication, I was like, I don't know how I've got through life. I really don't know how I have survived, because now that I'm medicated, I am just, you know, I'm probably a bit more dull. I'm not as flamboyant and fabulous, although I did wear leather pants in New York in February.
Very successfully as well.
Yeah. So, but you know, now that I'm medicated, it's like I take the pill and an hour later, I get this sense of like, not euphoria, but it's more just kind of a sense of, like everything just drops. And so I've been taking the pills now for just under a year, I think. And it's the pills and the medication and the understanding of my mindset and who I am as a person and my volatility, my reactivity, the fact that I'm very sensitive to rejection and get quite paranoid at times as well. You know, it's that knowledge of who I am that has allowed me and enabled me just to feel like I'm in a great place.
Can I ask, John, like, and, you know, expand as much or as little as you feel comfortable with, but what were the traits then? What were the things that your friend spotted when she read the book?
I think it was just kind of like the butterfly lifestyle, like jumping from one thing to the next. Right. It was the constant dopamine seeking. So, you know, be it joining OnlyFans, be it promiscuity, be it alcohol, be it drugs, be it walking 100 miles on my own, you know, just for the thrill of it. Like, it was those random things that people might look at and think, oh, he's great, what a laugh, what a great top bloke. But actually, when you boil it down to those things, it's actually quite concerning behaviour. And she said it out of concern and out of love for me. She was like, you know, it's I don't know how to tell you this, but I really think you should go and see someone. So it's just that very erratic, volatile, capricious lifestyle that I was living at the time. And, you know, there are still elements of me that are erratic and volatile and capricious. Of course there are, because that's who I've learned to be in my 35 years. But now that I know those are traits of mine, I'm much more able to control them and adapt lifestyle choices. And it's so liberating to feel that way.
How much of what you've just talked about and the ADHD and the symptoms that you've lived with for probably then many, many years were blurred and dulled out through drinking? Was it a case of that you removed the alcohol and then everything was maybe more exaggerated, or you were clearer? Although you have said, you know, it took somebody else, didn't it, to say to you, John, this is maybe where you're at. Just maybe talk us through a bit of that.
Yeah, so the alcohol definitely kind of blurred any concern about it. Like, you know, if you have a drink, it blurs the shame, it blurs the guilt, it blurs the kind of feeling of not being quite normal, whatever that means, you know, of being another. And so my sobriety, really, I had already started to think about the fact that I might be ADHD or might be autistic as I was getting sober last year. And then it was my friend who was the catalyst, Concepta. She said, look, she said, this book is a Bible for ADHD. So go and get tested. So yeah, the alcohol. But I think what's interesting is the comorbidity of alcoholism and ADHD and eating disorders, because I'm bulimic as well, and ADHD. Because interestingly, the pill that I'm on, Elvance, lisdexamfetamine, they use that in Australia and in some American states to treat bulimia as well, because it's an appetite suppressant. And part of ADHD is that you don't ever feel like you're full, whether that's food, bulimia for me, or whether it's alcoholism for me. You know, right. That's what I think, it's the ADHD that led me to, as soon as I had that first drink, to want to drink until I blacked out, till I'd got a gram of cocaine, till I'd woken up in a stranger's bed or on the dirty floor of a nightclub. So what's interesting is about 4 months ago, after I'd been on my pills for a good 8 months, I said to myself in the garden with Paul's family, because Paul's family, his mum and dad and sisters, they are the people I think I would trust more than anyone in the world, after my own family, of course. And I said, right, I'm going to have a bottle of beer, and I want you to tell me how I act, what happens, and if you think you can see a shift in me. So I had a few sips of this beer and nothing, absolutely nothing. It didn't trigger. You know, when you used to drink, you'd get that feeling. Mm. It didn't do a single thing for me. And I looked at this bottle of beer and I thought, I'm sober. I don't want this. And I've had, you know, half a bottle now and I don't want it. And so, yeah, that's probably taken me back. I have to now technically say I'm so many days sober, but I'm not worried about that, because what that was for me was an experiment, and it showed me how far I've come and also how severely my ADHD affected my alcoholism. I think, I really, really think many, many more people with alcoholism should go and get seen by a psychiatrist for ADHD or autism. I really, really do. I think the comorbidity is quite high. I've not got the figures off the top of my head, but the comorbidity between the two is very, very high.
I haven't got that figure, but I have. You just talking about it then reminded me, Shaz, what you said about our members and how it comes up. One of our members a while ago, I helped put together a press release because she was doing some work in this area. And the stat that I've got here, ADHD affects over 1.5 million adults in the UK, yet only 4.9% of women will be diagnosed in their lifetime compared to 12% of men. Like, it's quite low, isn't it? It's this quote here that really sticks out to me. She said, I wish I could go back in time and tell my younger self, it's okay, it's not your fault. Is that something that you can relate to now that you've got that diagnosis?
It is. And also, it makes me wish I could go back in time and say to my family, you know, he's a bit different. So adapt how you are with him. Because, you know, growing up, it was always a little shit. They never said he's a little shit. They're not like that. But, you know, I'm paraphrasing. They'd be like, oh, he's difficult. You were difficult when you were a kid. And now I look back and I feel like crying for myself, because I was struggling. I didn't know how to behave. I was seeking dopamine. I was, you know, they used to think it was the E numbers in the sweets. And that probably did proliferate the ADHD. But I was hyperactive. I wanted to be stood up in the nursery singing on my own. We used to sing Bar Bar Black Sheep, and I'd say, me on my own now. So, you know, I wish I could go back and educate the world, not just for my sake, but for any kid who was and still is growing up in a world that isn't designed to accept or work with who they are. You know, it's still the case. So many naughty children are just passed off as naughty children, when actually what they are is they're different, they're diverse, and they're struggling to fit into this world that is designed to be neurotypical. And I think part of my alcoholism was not just the dopaminergic responses from ADHD, but also the need to suppress the shame from that as well, from being the naughty little boy. It's so complex, isn't it?
It's just like a relentless cycle of shit, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Sorry to be so blunt about it, but
is it,
you know,
not sure that's
about
a technical term.
Well, it's my term.
Mr. Wake, you're stuck in the relentless cycle of shit. Thank you, Dr. Hartley.
It is. It's utterly relentless, and you go round and round and round until you make that leap and you break that chain, and you can look back now with clarity. Oh, man alive. John, you must feel, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm going to ask you the question, but so free.
I do. That's exactly how I feel. I feel free from bullshit. Like, I do feel free from bullshit, my own bullshit and the bullshit of others. Like, in the past, if there was ever gossip or anything like that, I'd be like, oh, get involved. Now I'm like, I do not want to know. I have got no interest. This has no bearing on me. If it's not true, don't say it. Just keep your bullshit to yourself, please, because I've got a life to live here. And that's the most empowering thing. I am that bullshit older woman, you know.
Your dreams came true, John.
I'm finally Beryl.
I totally know what you mean about that kind of, I'm just free from bullshit. And I want to dig into it a bit more, because I think this is the thing that, one of the things that people can find really, really difficult, because we had a great time last time you were on the podcast, and it was great to get to know you a bit. And I know that you and Shaz message. All right, John Waite, text me again. All right, Shaz, with your showbiz mates. He might message me back on Instagram soon. Anyway,
but he didn't.
DM, but it's fine.
I've got so many DMs to get through.
I know, because you're so showbiz and glamorous. But I think the
I'm not. I'm a baker.
You're a baker. The whole kind of the bit about being confident to say things. You know, that kind of, you know, I am free from bullshit. I think that kind of, I've got a quote on my quotes board somewhere about, it's Aaron Eckhart, your life begins when you stop caring what other people think. Easy to say.
So true.
Yeah, but it, really easy to say, but so hard to implement. You do seem like last year we got on so well. It does seem like there's a different version of you on Zoom today.
Does it?
You were chilled, but there's definitely a confidence there when you speak that, you know, I'm kind of been drawn into the Zoom because you just, so much authority in your voice, but you're saying these, like, where does that confidence start to grow from? Because it's an easy thing to say, but it is a very difficult thing to actually do.
Well, what's interesting is I've always been confident and outgoing, but that came from a place of great fragility. And I think having had the chance over these past 18 months, however longer, to introspect and to look at who I am, I've been able to fill that confidence with valid confidence. And that comes from an understanding of who I am. You know, all the shame of being the naughty boy, of growing up gay and all of this stuff, I'm now at peace with. I'm at peace with it. And that quote is exactly right. Say it again. Tell me again.
Here we go. The day you stop caring what other people think of you is the day your life begins, Aaron Eckhart.
Look, I don't know how else better to say it.
It's a good one, isn't it? I don't give a shit.
And not in a kind of pompous, obnoxious way where, oh, I don't care what anyone thinks. It's more of a, I will do my best to be a good citizen. It's like I'm preaching to the
Keir
Starmer, doesn't it now? But, you know, I'll do my best to be a good citizen, a good son, a good brother, a good husband, a good friend. I'll do my best. I'll fuck up. I'll make messes. Of course I will. But all I can do is my best. And I can give you everything I've got, but don't ask for more than that because I don't have it. And I'm now much more, as soon as I see a text message from someone asking for something, in the past I'd be like, oh yeah, babe, I'll do it, yeah. Now I'm just like, I'll reply in a few days and then I'll let you know. And more often than not, it's a no because it doesn't align with who I am right now. And I'm too bloody busy. I'm working all the hours God sends at the minute. And I respect like that as well. I respect my team. I respect my husband. I want to be here at the end of the day after a long shift to be with my husband and to cuddle on the sofa. Like we've done all the stuff. We've done all the trying to manicure a beautiful lawn. This is a figurative. I'm speaking dramatically now and poetically, but actually it's the wildflowers that are the most beautiful, isn't it? It's the stuff that's already there that you don't need to plant and pluck. It's there. So nurture it.
This is going on Ben's. I saw his face light up then. It'll be on your board.
If you've brought us on to flowers, John, so my other new favourite is whatever seed you are, bloom.
Atticus. Oh,
isn't that a nice one?
Oh, the pair of you.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
Whatever seed you are, bloom.
This is an hour of goosebumps for me.
we try our best. But it's, I think, if society felt a bit more like that, you know, whoever you are, whoever you want to be, whatever you want to do, but also kind of, you know, and so that's kind of, if that was the societal view and then the individual's view was, I'm not going to be an ass about this, but, you know, no is a complete sentence and that doesn't work for me in my life. And I feel like the world would be a happier place. So basically, everyone, you just need to get this out there. Everyone needs to listen to this conversation and we'll fix every problem.
I think that is a particular problem with Britain as well. Like, I think we're so...
Yeah, I agree.
I think we're often so polite. Like, if you go to Scandi countries, they're like, oh, you're so polite, you're British. And our politeness, I think, doesn't come from a place of respect, but it comes from a place of insecurity and wanting to do the right thing because we don't know what's right or wrong. And as we saw with the election, as we saw with all the stuff that's been going on in the past 12 months, we've seen how polarised our country actually is. And I do think if our country took a much more kind of chilled approach, it would be a happy... We might not be as economically amazing, not that we are anymore anyway, but, you know, I think for so long people have put profit before purpose, haven't they? And the things that go with either of those things, it just, there's so much polarisation and it's very sad to see. But again, I don't get sucked into that. I'm just like, oh, well.
If you ever stand for Prime Minister John, you know, Keir Starmer had one word behind him, change. Maybe yours could just be chill.
Chill, yeah. Chill out.
Yeah, yeah.
Just well, I couldn't because the things I've done, you know, I've done all sorts, haven't I? I've sold pictures of my penis on OnlyFans. Like, come on, you know, I couldn't be a Prime Minister. I've got too many skeletons in my closet.
Well, they're not in your closet, though, are they?
No, they're out there.
They're
not in your closet.
No,
they're plastered all over the internet.
Oh man, you've just thrown me there. I had a question.
I've got one. I feel like we should talk about this new venture then, John. You know, you've mentioned it a couple of times. Let's, you know, for those who don't know about it, what have you left the glamorous world of TV behind for? What's going on?
No, I've left the glamorous world of television and the glitter ball of Strictly to bake brownies.
I love it. So, rough puff brownies.
So we were in, I've thought about it a while ago, when I was filming Food on Wrap for Channel 4, which is like an investigative behind-the-scenes food programme, I would go into all these factories and I saw how these factories were just a scaled-up version of what I already do at home, you know, or in the bakery. And I was thinking, what can I do? We can't really have a bakery because we've not got the premises, we've not got the car parking space, but I want to do something. And I think a part of that realization was through sobriety as well, and starting to respect the skill that I had as a baker. You know, I'm a classically trained pastry chef now, and I kind of shied away from that in the past, but actually it's a skill. And so I thought, I need to do this. I need to do something with this. And then my friend Kate has got a company called Gower Cottage Brownies, and she set that up just around the time I won Bake Off, so 13 years ago. And she's doing incredibly well with it. And I thought, well, I could do brownies, but I could do them a bit fancy, a bit special. Like, I could do the familiar but fabulous. So at first I was like, ooh, let's call it familiar but fabulous. And then I remembered making Steph McGovern laugh by calling myself a rough puff on Steph's packed lunch. And I thought, well, rough puff, yeah, it's a bit of a joke on what the boys used to call me at school. So I thought, well, rough puff has got a double meaning, because it's rough is the familiar, what we already know, what we love. And the puff is all the stuff around it, the extra, the sparkle. So Rough Puff is the perfect. It was either going to be a brownie company or a crap boy band name, wasn't it?
Brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And can I say, when you launched, I tried to get some. Sold out. They do flipping well, don't they?
Oh, they're doing so well. I mean, you know, we didn't know what would happen. We just did not know where it would go. And we kept selling out within minutes. And within about a month, we put an advert out to hire. So we've hired a full-time baker. We've just hired a part-time baker as well, who's doing all the cookies. We've got a packer who's worked with us for a while now, but he's now our official packer. My nephew is building the boxes. I'm in there every day. My husband comes home after a full-time job and helps pack as well. So it's, you know, touch wood, it's really going from strength to strength. And I really believe that sobriety and my approach to life is partly to thank for that. You know, the team that I've now got working with me is they're the magic ones. They're amazing. They put the puff in the rough. But I wouldn't have done this had I not been sober.
You know what I love about this, and it's just another example. So we spoke to Claire Pooley on the podcast, author of the Sober Diaries, years ago now. She stopped drinking, started writing again. Now, you know, international, amazing author. There was an artist called Paul Locke, 10 years sober when we spoke to him again a couple of years ago. He stopped drinking, he picked up paintbrushes, and he...
As a hobby,
talent.
Wasn't it? Like, he was just like, oh,
it was
this
a try. Hobby.
The class down the road. And now he's like a world, like just
world renowned. Art.
Yeah, amazing.
Just
so
the
cool.
Most stunning stuff. And then we've got examples of people in our community. I always refer to Ali in the States, stopped drinking, literally just picked up a crochet needles, something she hadn't done for years and years and years. And you hear so often of people just reigniting a spark from years ago. And it's so brilliant to hear that you're now back in that space from, you know, as you said, you were qualified. Did you say qualified pastry chef? Qualified pastry chef. It's difficult for me to say. And you've gone back to that now and loving life with your brownies. I think it's fantastic.
Well, I think what alcohol does is it blinkers you to who you are, but also who you can be. It dulls you and numbs you and blinds you to your potential, to your complete potential. And sobriety gives you ambition, it gives you foresight, it gives you insight, it gives you the whole picture, doesn't it? You know, it just, the things that you can do, like, and the money I've saved. I never had savings. I used to, you know, I didn't spend everything, but I never really had any personal wealth. But now I've got ISAs, I've got leases, we've been overpaying our mortgage by 100% every month since we got sober, because Paul's sober too, my husband.
Brilliant.
100% every month we've been paying off our mortgage because we were squandering that much money, not solely on alcohol. But when you drink, you become much more inhibited, don't you? You become much more fickle and frivolous. And I think that percolates into everyday life when you drink. Like, you'll say yes to things that you shouldn't say yes to more easily. And so alcohol, the lack of alcohol in our life has given us so much. It's given us a business. It's given us a bit of money in the bank. It's given us time together. We value our, I value our time so much.
Just had a message come into the chat box from community member Jules. I bought a food brand over 12 years and getting sober gave me the headspace to exit the company. And now I am retired at 50. Thank God for sobriety and for OTI. Pretty cool.
Great hummus. Brilliant hummus, Jules.
About to say, yeah, because I keep buying the hummus going, that's Jules' hummus. Is it still your hummus?
It's not
Jules' hummus anymore. Oh, how about that? John, I know you're a huge fan of the show, so you know this already. But just for those who are listening for the first time, because it's you. It's amazing how often these conversations come back to self-awareness. And because I'm always trying to find the key, the secret. Like, what's the thing that we can kind of really easily tell everyone, do this and then this will happen? And so much of it, the kind of success that you're describing that's happened since you've removed alcohol, both personally and professionally, so much of that comes back to being self-aware enough to make some big and bold decisions, doesn't it? You know, going, right, this is how I want to live. And it's not selfish. It's just authentic, isn't it? To go, this is how I want to live. This is how I want to be. This is how I want to engage with the people I love and the people that I work with and the people I respect. So much of it's self-awareness. I'm so excited for you, John.
Thank
it's
you.
So cool what you're doing.
It's so true. I think when you look at it and you question, when people ask, you know, what is the biggest barrier to who or where I want to be? The answer is you. You're that barrier. And if you're drinking, you on alcohol is that barrier. There's only one barrier in your life and it's you. Sod what everyone else thinks. Get sober and bloody do it, because you can. You can do anything when you're sober. I truly believe that. Last year we started going to the Manchester Buddhist Centre and doing meditation courses. We did a 6-week course and it was amazing, just the clarity and the peace of mind that brought as well. You know, we would never have done that. We would have gone out every Tuesday. If we'd gone to Manchester on a Tuesday night, it would have been to go on a bender. So, you know, it just gives you so much time and so much just calmness, doesn't it?
It's amazing how one thing can take you off in, you know, completely different directions. You drink alcohol and then the bad habits kind of stack on top of each other. You have a few drinks and then whatever else, and then you have a kebab on the way home, and then you don't get up and do that thing in the morning, and the bad habits stack. Because actually when you remove alcohol, the good habits start to stack. Have you heard Chaz's news, by the way? John, Chaz is exciting. You can do anything when you remove alcohol news.
Oh, don't. It gives me palpitations.
What are you doing?
Well, would you agree, John, that it's, you know, removing alcohol, It's life-changing magic, wouldn't you say? It's the life-changing magic of quitting alcohol. Available the 2nd of January, 2025. Oh, yeah. Shaz is an author now.
It's so exciting.
I'm not an author yet. I'm not an author yet. I hopefully will be 2nd of January, 2025.
How much have you written of it?
Done, mate. Boxed off.
Go on.
John. Nobody told me it was really, really hard writing a book.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Give us a
brief synopsis. Come on, what can we expect to find from this?
You need to get
book?
Good at this, Shaz. Come on, you need to be able to just roll these off.
Come on.
Bang, bang, bang.
You've done this. You've done it. So sell it. Believe in yourself. Come on, you've worked bloody hard to get where you are today.
Don't even make me cry. I am. I'm really proud and I'm really overwhelmed. But I struggle with imposter syndrome massively. Massively. Anyway, the book is called The Life-Changing Magic of Quitting Alcohol, Stop Drinking and Start Living. And Ben asked me this question last week. He said, what inspired you, Sharon, to write the book? Because like you said a minute ago, John, get sober and bloody do it. And I want people to know, no matter where you are, with your drinking relationship, no matter how much shit it's causing you or whatever. In fact, it doesn't even have to be causing you that much of a problem. You can just stop drinking and remove that one thing from your life, and absolutely everything has the potential to change. And I just want people to know that there's life on the other side of it, and it's not about surviving and clinging on. It's just about thriving. And so it's a handhold through early sobriety, to just to let you know that it's all going to be all right if you stick with it and just keep going.
Oh, I'm going to scream about it from the rooftops. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be incredible. No, it's like, because there isn't really, there's not much, there is material out there, but knowing you and knowing how infectious you are and how much you can help people with the podcast, with everything you post about, it's going to be bloody brilliant. So
thank you.
Everybody should buy a copy now, pre-order a copy now.
No, just hold that thought. We're going to announce the pre-orders, I think, September, a couple of months' time. But yeah, it's all happening. It's been a process. It really has.
And right at the start of that process, you said you couldn't do it. You said, I can't do this. Right at the start, you said, I can't do it. And now you've done it, and it's there.
I didn't think I could stop drinking either.
Exactly. You know?
In fact, I didn't think I wanted to stop drinking, which is...
And when you can stop drinking in a country that is designed now, you know, socially, economically, this country is designed to sell and pump out alcohol. The tax receipts that the government get from alcohol, in a country that is designed to make people drink, the fact that you've broken away from the pack and now written a book about it, well, you'll have disciples. We're your disciples now.
I love this. Can we bring this episode back to questioning, yes, John, please?
Yes, okay. Well,
John, we're a community, aren't we?
Like, no, we are.
It's not all about
me.
It's about Jules and a hummus. It's about all of us.
Yeah, well, it's amazing.
A question from our community. You're talking there, John, about how we live in a society where it's very geared towards drinking. Do you still get triggered? Adam's asked, what are your go-to things if you get triggered? Do you still feel that way?
Very, very rarely now. Very, very rarely indeed. Like if what I might find triggering is the kind of retrospection and thinking, oh my God, imagine getting in at 6 o'clock in the morning or getting the last train home from Manchester. Imagine that. Like, no, that feeling of having a white wine hangover, the worst hangover you could have. But if I ever feel like, do I want to drink? I instantly say no. And I find that a lovely cuddle on the couch with Paul often would take any, there's never a feeling, there's never an inclination, but it would take away the thought. Because Matthew, who works at Ruff Puff, he's our baker, he's amazing. He says, if you entertain the thought, you've already done it. You've got to have that strength to say, no, not today, Satan. And that's how I feel now. Even if there's like a little murmur and it's like, no, we're not going to go there. So piss off.
Takes strength though, doesn't it? It takes strength and work to constantly make that decision. Say, no, you know what? No.
What is strength but time? You know, that's all it is let time make you stronger. Just trust the process. That's all it is, time.
I love that. Because you're right, you almost, like we asked you, I don't know if we were recording or not, you said, how alcohol-free are you now, John? You mean, I can't even remember, I don't count. Mm. You know, and there'll be a day where, you know, you were counting, like I was counting, and there's a day where you just don't. You don't even realise you stopped.
At the start, it's that ladder, isn't it? And it's that those goals. It's about creating a new pattern of behaviour. And once that new pattern of behaviour is there, you don't need the crutch anymore. It's like, you know, counting was like my mum looking after me when I was a little boy. And now I'm strong. I'm on my own. I've still got her. She's there. But, you know, I'm strong now. I can do this. And I don't need that crutch anymore.
Very wise, John. It's great to have you. What's on the that? Pod. Can we do this annually?
It's great. Yeah.
This is our second.
I'll come back next year.
Okay, great.
Definitely. Good. It's absolutely flown by. Let's have a quick look at these messages. I realise we are fast running out of time.
Well, here we go. Here's one. Does it help to be in a great relationship? That's an interesting question.
It does. And I think the fact that Paul, my husband and partner now, nearly 17 years this year. I think,
wow.
I know. I think the fact that he also said no to the bottle has been a huge help.
Do you mind if I ask when he did that, John? Was that because of your choices or was Paul already sober, alcohol-free? However,
no,
you want to describe
it? I think
it?
He saw what it was doing to me. And he knew that if he went sober too, he could support me. he could be there for me. Okay. And he could, so it was really a kind of sacrifice that he made. And then 6 months in, he was like, I don't ever want to drink again.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It's amazing. But
that his decision wasn't decisive for you. You were doing it, but being in this good relationship has just helped. Yeah. Okay.
I would have done it either way, but the fact that we did it together is, you know, and of course my sister as well, she's 5 years sober now, and she's done the same thing as me. She's gone sober and set up businesses and become this amazing, incredible, well, she was already an amazing, incredible woman, but she's allowed that woman to blossom now. Yeah, I think
fantastic.
Surrounding yourself not necessarily with a partner, but with people who, and the people that you lose when you stop drinking, you don't mourn those losses. You actually think, thank God they're gone out of my life, because they were drains.
It's so important, isn't it, to have your little team of sober cheerleaders, however that looks for you. Yeah.
Whether
your
it's
life.
One or 10, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, amazing. It's been such a good chat, but it's gone too fast. It's really, really
nice. I can't believe the time.
Honestly.
That was like 20 past.
I'd love you to come back, and I know Ben will echo this as well, but so will some of our community members, if you fancied it, John, to talk more specifically about your ADHD diagnosis and the relationship with alcohol at some point.
Absolutely.
I think that would be fantastic to focus, I think, purely on that at some point as well, because I know people listening to this now are affected. I know people that are currently living that as well and waiting for a diagnosis and all the rest of it. So that would be amazing.
In some places, it's 7 years waiting list for diagnosis. You know, really.
What?
Wait. Honestly. And people, you know, some people take their life because of ADHD during that time. And the fact that there's still people who roll their eyes and think it's a made-up nonsense, it's so sad. We need to really, really, really reform the way that we look at mental health and neurodiversity. And I think that's happening now in schools. I think people have talked about it in schools a bit more. But I'd love to come and chat about more about that. Because
one of our members just put, I'm a year into a 7-year list.
Wow. Well, if you can ever muster up the funds to do it privately, bloody do it. Because, you know, if you believe your ADHD, and if you're saving money not drinking, and you can just about cobble together the pennies to do it, because the sooner you can get 13 grand, no, it's not 13 grand, is it?
There's a conversation now going off in a chat box.
Somebody else has said 2 years waiting, haven't even started on the autism yet, which is, another story, another diagnosis. Yeah. There's a lot more to talk about. John, we'll do that at some point.
We need to do that, definitely.
Yeah. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure. Before you go, please, will you just give a quick plug to your book and your brownies? Because, like me, John's also an author, but I didn't know if you knew that.
I did know that, yeah. I'm very impressed on this guy. I'm like, look, the people that I spend, they say surround yourself with people that you aspire to be, you know. I'm totally there.
Are you?
You're pretty good at who you are, Ben. You're pretty good at who you are.
Thanks, mate. Thank you.
The book's old news. I'm not plugged to book.
Oh, come on, plug the book. Oh, no. Plug the bloody book.
No, my publisher will probably put a horse's head in my bed tonight if I don't. But it's just a memoir, dancing on eggshells. That's all I'm going to say. But it's the sad thing about that is that the press made it all about Strictly last year, and it's not about Strictly. It's a little bit about Strictly. So the book's there if you want it, read it. If you don't matter. It's propping up my door at the minute anyway, so it's a very good doorstop. And then Rough Puff Brownies is my little baby, my little sober baby, and I love it. I love the people who have come into it. I love the people who buy from us, the customers. You get a few knobheads every now and again moaning because, you know, the brownie's not arrived or it's a day late, but most people are lovely about that. They're like, oh, we're so, we know how hard you're working, but some people are a bit like, when people demand compensation, if the brownies are an hour late, you just think, sod off, pal, sod off. I've got another batch of brownies to make. I'm not going to answer this email.
John Waite, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
You're
joining us and Over the Influence.
Thanks for everything you guys do. Thanks to your community as well. It's lovely to see some people.